This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run begins. It's a slow ascent into the stratosphere. I believe it's a Monday, so it's also a slow ascent throughout the week from a Monday to a Friday, but you know.
And also presumably the first full week back for those Raya travelers, you know, those who took that extended break over the last week.
Yeah, so those who are lucky enough to take that, and myself, you know, I was slightly unwell and under the weather, so I didn't come into work. The doctor gave me 3 days MC, so, you know, whoopee for me.
well, certainly glad to have you back. Oh, it sounds like you still got a little bit of something.
Yeah, I still do have a little bit of something. But, you know, there's always something to go around. And if you look at the headline news, of course, you know, Hong Kong is there, big story there, because over the weekend we've had several major anniversaries. One, of course, was the anniversary of the handing over of Hong Kong. Also, we had the Canadian government celebrating 150 years of being a country.
Wow.
And also the first anniversary of that terrible massacre that claimed 20 lives at the Holy Artisan Bakery in Dhaka, Bangladesh. If you remember that, Han, it also had kind of a Malaysian link, because one of the young men involved in the massacre, meaning doing the killing, studied here at one of our local private universities. And what was exceptional about that massacre, it was all the young men recruited to this militant Islamic group were in fact from elite families. Mm. So they were from rich, affluent, well-connected families, and they became the fodder for this vicious ideology.
And by way of refresher, you know, this, again, like you said, happened a year ago.
Yeah, the 1st of July.
Right, and it involved a 12-hour siege, you know, and there were 100 commandos who actually had to storm that bakery. Authorities said it was local militants, not Islamic State, which carried out the attack.
And yeah, that's also part of we in fact, did some analysis on that, and there's a Pressing Matters show that you can download where we do a deep dive analysis of what happened there and the politics of Bangladesh. So even the denial by the government may be not to be taken at face value because of the local politics.
Well, nevertheless, you know, it resulted in 2 days of national mourning for Bangladesh. So certainly highlighting the, you know, tragic and the scale and the importance of such a tragedy to Bangladesh.
Yeah. Also in the news, Singapore had its you know, now become traditional annual LGBT rally called the Pink Dot. But the government has passed a law there that says you have to be a citizen or a permanent resident to participate. Foreigners not allowed.
So a xenophobic LGBT rally?
No, well, it was not the rally organizers that imposed the ban. It was the government of Singapore. Hmm. And so we'll leave it at that. Pink Dot says it all. Okay, also Stephen Hawking criticizes Donald Trump over his anti-climate change stance, saying this could damage the planet. And he invoked that terrible five-letter word, Venus.
Oh,
we could start burning up and become as hot as Venus if we're not careful. So all that coming over the weekend. Great stuff. And then we have more to come. But first, Here Comes the Sun with the Beatles, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han. And that was the Beatles, Here Comes the Sun. The sun actually hasn't come out yet. No, it's still dark out there.
Yeah.
Thanks to daylight saving hours, which I think is
which doesn't apply to Earth.
It does, because you know, Kuala Lumpur time is actually Sabah time. You know that.
Oh yeah,
because so if you know,
we don't have like daylight savings, like, you know.
It says what happens is,
I mean, like, our time is constant. We don't have to change our clocks, like, you know, say the states.
That's right. We don't have that period where you kind of shift time.
Right.
But the idea was, in fact, a daylight savings thing, right?
Oh.
So the idea is you get up, as it were. I don't know if I'm using the term correctly, and I'll check this up after I finish talking, which is that you basically get up in darkness. You don't get up with the sun. You don't get up with the dark, which I believe some people say is not good for you. You should be getting up with the sun because that's natural. Oh. Yeah. And so, you know, when the sun goes down and you get sleepy, well, we used to.
Yeah,
well, our ancestors used to.
Okay, I was going to say, because the sun goes down at like, what, 7:30 here in Malaysia, but we go to bed at like, I don't know, what, 12:30?
Yeah, but
for most Malaysians.
Absolutely. And also, we have a lot of light. We have a lot of artificial light. Mm. But the idea is that when the sun goes down, your melatonin levels in your body increase, and that makes you sleepy.
I feel so informed right now.
Yeah, yes, so, you know, so anyway, so these light-emitting devices, some people call them smartphones, for instance. I mean, the television as well, and there's artificial lighting, of course, from your ceiling. But the smartphone issue comes back to us again and again. I think we've become much more conscious of the ill effects of smartphones. And we have an article here from Quartz Magazine that tells us about a new study. And the headlines got kind of sensational, though.
Yeah, so you've got this study by the done at the University of Texas in Austin, and they conducted experiments with 800 smartphone users. Essentially, they say that with your smartphones nearby, you could be dumber. Well, that's the headline. But, you know, I guess to put a more scientific spin to it, essentially your cognitive capacity is limited when you have your smartphone within reach. Now, I think that's...
Okay, so it's not... Okay, so what's happening here, right? So if you look, if you go a bit granular into the article, what it's suggesting is, it's not that you use it, because that's obviously one possibility. That, so it's distracting. So the participants were given a task in which they were, for which they needed to focus. But the fact that it was within view meant people were thinking about the phone and then trying not to think about the phone. So there's this double move. You see it, but then you try to suppress the thought of using it.
Right.
And that actually took away from focusing on the task at hand.
Well, and it wasn't just within view. You know, for some of these participants, it was out of view, like say in their bag or in their pocket, but still within reach. You know, and so they say it's still a brain drain having to consciously not think about your smartphone, not accessing it while concentrating at the task at hand. Yeah. Now, I wonder... You know,
The ones who did best were the ones who had their phone in another room.
Yeah, so not within reach, right. So, you know, I wonder again, you know, how applicable it is for us today, you know, because we are so, so dependent on our smartphones, especially for us here in the media, right?
Yeah, well, okay, so there's the media thing. Yeah, to some extent, because if you want immediate information or news, you know, you're not going to be listening to the radio, fans, for instance, for the news, because you can get your news constantly.
Right.
But I want to ask you about young people, because, you know, I grew up in the world where, you know, the first shopping mall appeared. This generation lives in a world where shopping malls are a given, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of things are given, including the smartphone. Now, and when we talk about dependency on things like smartphones, that's probably much more intense for those these new millennials. You have and teach young people, and do you find it very difficult to tell them to not reach for the phone while in class, for instance?
Well, so we tried that approach during my earlier years of, you know, working with high school kids, and it essentially got to the point where, because they just need to fidget, right, and they are just constantly fed with stimulation. So they need that stimulant constantly. So what we've actually done is actually try to incorporate smartphones into our lessons. So for example, we'll be reading something from the textbook. It's like, oh, this is interesting. Hey, this story happened. Let's all Google it right now. So then we can compare each other's search results as well. So they have that kind of interactivity, you know. So assimilating it into the classroom and making sure it's used in a controlled manner.
So you don't say, kids, let's go down to the library and browse the shelves and do some deep reading.
Dude, it's 2017, man. Who uses the library anymore?
That is so sad.
No, but
you know, there's something different about it. So you can't.
No, so instead of walking down the hall, you know, forming this singular file, you know, having everybody march down to the library and
You can walk in twos. Okay. You can hand in hand.
Yeah, sure. Right.
Remember the arc?
Yes, I do. Yes. Yeah. So instead of doing that, they can just reach for their phones and, you know, find that information, you know, immediately or almost immediately, and then that can spur that discussion right there and then. So it's information in real time. So, yeah. I mean, there is that trade-off. So on one hand, yeah, this experiment goes to show that our cognitive capacity might be limited if our smartphone is within reach.
Okay, now knowing that, would you now say to yourself, perhaps it would be an idea to ban the phone altogether and get the kids to just focus on things like the reading or the discussion that's happening in the class. I mean, would you ever consider that? I mean, do studies like this, you know, produced on popular magazines or websites, platforms, do they actually change the way you think about the world?
Well, as a teacher in that context, you know, within the context of a classroom, I would say no, because again, the textbook doesn't have, you know, everything that we need, right? And so often we are chided for just sticking to the textbook. So in trying to enrich the students, Jay, my spiel all coming out already, enrich their learning experience, you've got the smartphone, use it. Use it, because guess what? Moving forward, we won't necessarily come to a time where we will not use a smartphone. It's knowing how to use them wisely, use them productively and efficiently. I think that's the name of the game.
Wow, well said, well said. Okay, Tan Chung Han there. Coming up, there is a light that never goes out, and that's the light emitting devices there. There you have it, by The Smiths, one of my favorite bands after these ads, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was The Smiths with There is a Light That Never Goes Out. A band and a genre my friends politely refer to as homosexual death rock. Well, that was because in the 80s, we were different then. Okay, Tan Chung Han and myself, Shahad Kushan, with you on the morning run. Just a quick reminder that this is the anniversary of many things. Over the weekend, we had many anniversaries, but the 1st of July was the anniversary of the Dhaka massacre, the Holy Artisan Bakery. And we tweeted out a link to a story that we did, an interview we did with a journalist in Bangladesh who explains and gives context to that terrible incident. Also, but you know, the world is also full of beauty and positive things. And I just wanted to highlight one of them, which is the story of a young woman from Sabah, whose name is Avita Del Mundo. Mm. And she caused quite a stir, apparently, Han, because she auditioned for the Malaysian stage of the Miss Universe pageant.
All right. And so the stir...
And that's not shocking.
Right.
That itself is not shocking.
So the stir comes from the fact that she has a skin condition. I hope I'm going to pronounce this correctly. It's called giant congenital melanocytic nervus. So essentially, she's got large moles, you know, all over her body. And
so that's just a symptom of the underlying problem that she has.
Well,
right?
I think that's the name of the condition. Yeah. So she's got large moles covering all over her body. There is a picture from her Instagram. I believe this looks like an Instagram page. I don't know. I'm not on Instagram. Are you on Instagram?
No.
Perhaps you can validate
no,
this. Okay.
No.
Well, it looks like an Instagram screenshot on an article on the MalaysianInsight.com. So you can check it out there. And okay, I can understand how that can cause a stir, you know, because, again, she doesn't fit the molds of what one would deem conventional beauty.
You said mold, right?
Mold.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, mold. It was not intended, okay? But in her bid for the Malaysian stage of this Miss Universe pageant, I think it's really, really important. I certainly applaud her for it because it certainly sends out a message, you know, about, you know, how do we define beauty, really?
Okay. So, part of it is another of the story. But just to give more context, she, of course, was teased as a young kid because kids are kind of cruel that way. Mm. She was called Giant Chipsmore, which, of course, is a biscuit with chocolate chips in it. Yeah. Or she was called Monster. Now, looking at the picture, she's actually quite a pretty girl with a great smile. It's just that her skin condition would make you do a double take just because it's slightly unusual in the way that even somebody with freckles might make you. But this is just on the kind of on the spectrum, something a little more eye-grabbing, as it were, because of the extremity of the presence of moles, right? So the question, would you describe it that way?
Well, yeah, no, it's okay. But also, no, and again, I would like to applaud her, because I would think this takes a lot of courage, you know, for her to, again, go out there and actually submitting a bid into the Miss
Universe. Yeah, I mean, anybody who wants to go for a beauty contest, I think, is very brave. Just because you're subjecting yourself to this constant assessment about your body and your looks.
True.
And yes, they say they care about your personality, but do they really?
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, and then you have to wear all kinds of costumes in order to kind of do that. So that endless scrutiny is I imagine, would be very terrifying. I wouldn't want to subject myself to a beauty contest.
Well, questions and criticisms about the nature or the justification for Miss Universe pageants or beauty pageants in general aside, nevertheless, I think the fact that she actually made that bid and the fact that we are actually talking about it, and also there's an article on the Malaysian Insight about it, again, you know, shows that there is this need, or certainly there's space for us to discuss what really is beauty and, you know, how far does physical beauty even matter?
Now, so it's kind of window shop, right? So if you think of the skin, your skin as being a sign of something, and remember, this is a constant topic for discussion. You know, what does beauty really mean? Mm. But I think universally, bad skin really is one of those things that science sends up a signal, because it's often a sign of a disease, right? So if you have skin that looks diseased, whether it's acne or whatever, it does seem to send flags up. And I don't know if this is something about our you know, animal past, as it were, how we're hardwired, because we're always choosing a mate that, you know, would be genetic, would carry on the genetic, or add to the genetic pool. So should we reach to those arguments when it comes to beauty, that beauty is really about good genetic material?
Well, so here comes the nature versus nurture debate, right? So, you know, on one hand, you might say this could be ingrained in nature, right? It has roots in our biological instincts. But I would also say that, you know, it could be a sign of nurture, right? Because we've been socialized to say that this is beautiful, flawless skin, or, you know, fair skin, right? We had that debacle recently with a local pharmacy, right? Oh, fair skin is beautiful.
Watson's, yeah.
Well, okay. You know, you went there. So again, you know, being able to challenge those notions would, I think, certainly go a long ways in terms of, you know, making sure that we become this liberal and, you know, hopefully more enlightened society.
Inclusive, actually. So now, kids, whip out your smartphones and Google nature versus nurture.
Oh.
Right?
Very good. And
very good.
Sure, very beautiful today.
Okay. Thank you very much. And here's somebody who also very beautiful. Pat Benatar, hit me with your best shot. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Blondie with Sunday Girl, because today is the Monday, not the Sunday anymore. And, I'm still Sharad Kutin, and you're still Tan Chung Han, apparently.
Yeah, and not a girl.
Not a girl.
So, Monday guys.
And you're not, and you know, woe be to you, because, you know, women hold up half the sky, thank you very much.
Well,
that says Mao Zedong. Okay.
Yes. It wasn't meant as a sexist statement. It was a fact. I am a guy.
Yeah,
it's
okay.
A Monday.
Oh, it's a Anyways. Monday. Okay. But nature versus nurture. Kids, Google it. Okay. What does it mean when he says, I'm a guy? Guys and girls. Interesting point, because we had a blogger who blogged about her weight in the airport, a recent stint at KLIA. I don't know if it was KLIA 1 or 2.
Looks like 1.
1. And and the headline of her blog post, because now not only can everybody fly, but everybody can be a journalist, apparently, was the headline read something like sex segregation at airports.
And let me just read it verbatim. The headline reads, KLIA implementing male and female segregation during boarding.
Okay.
Which is wrong on a couple of accounts, but anyways, go on.
So that has now been, clarifications come from the Malaysian Airports Holding Berhad, MAHB, saying they'd never implemented such a policy, and that the instance that the passenger experienced was one that came out of a situation where there were fewer female security guards and security personnel. And so the segregation was there to expedite the situation where you had a lopsided amount of female to male security personnel, right? So, and when I was reading this, Han, I thought to myself, why did the person so quickly jump to the segregation narrative. And, you know, and because we know that in Malaysia, there's limited amounts of segregation in public spaces between men and women as compared to many countries. I mean, there are countries that are very democratic and secular that have segregation. For instance, India has segregation in buses. And so you have the female portion and male portion. To my complete shock as a young man traveling in India, boarding the female section of that. And I've also recently experienced the same thing where I found myself inadvertently in a female queue, not knowing I was queuing up. And I, you know, I just thought, well, there are lots of women in my queue, but you know, I didn't know.
And part of my college experience in the States, yeah, this is in the States, involved some time at a college which practiced a tremendous amount of segregation. Different pool times for men and women, different elevators, different stairwells.
But you went to a college that was religious. It was a Christian college.
For a little bit, for a little bit.
And it was a conservative one. So, so, and that's where I think this is coming from. I think there are a lot of us in Malaysia who are aware of this narrative of increasing conservatism in Malaysia. And every time we see something that is apparently an instance of this increasing conservatism, we panic. And so what I understand, what I'm reading from the blogger, though that's not stated, is this, perhaps you can call it a liberal secular panic attack when seeing segregation.
Right. Now, that's if you're seeing this episode, you know, via that lens being with that of a liberal, what do you call it? Liberal panic attack?
Secular panic attack.
Yeah, that one. You know, but I would say if you're trying to ascertain where Malaysian society as a whole falls in the spectrum, right, between, say, you know, full-on segregation versus a liberal like target, everybody shares the same bathroom, you know, that end of the spectrum, right? And I dare say that Malaysia is generally a more conservative society, right, compared to other economies. I mean, just take it at face value. You know, if for you ladies out there listening right now, you know, how many of you would be comfortable with a male security agent or security personnel patting you down at the airport?
And or the opposite as well, for men to be patted down by women. I think the point, though, is within the Malaysian narrative of conservatism is that it's increasingly conservative. So there was time, if you look at social media, there's always this kind of, we're picking up on the older, say that what was happening in the 60s and 70s, we're looking at film that was, and saying, well, Malaysian films have changed in terms of what was permissible and not permissible, women's dress or the relationship between men and women. I mean, we go from P. Ramlee to Ombak Rindu, right? And it's such a sea shift, right? I mean, the idea that a story like Ombak Rindu could have been won audiences over in the 60s, I mean, it's here speculation, of course, because you know that Ombak Rindu story where a woman eventually marries her rapist. And, you know, and it's an extraordinarily misogynistic tale, but became extraordinarily popular as well. So what we're looking at is a narrative not of just like, okay, we're a conservative society, but we're increasingly conservative.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, no, and I can see that, no, and we, if we're going to use empirical evidence, you know, as this blogger has done, you can build that narrative. You know, and I mean, isn't it telling that, well, it appears to be a global symptom whereby, you know, there's this heightened sense of conservatism, and, you know, we're seeing it in economies, not just like, not just Malaysia, but also in our ASEAN neighbors and also in the Middle East, at least. And there is this pushback against this liberal thought. And I'm sure this liberal secular panic attacks, it's not just isolated to this incident. It's happened all around the world, right?
Yeah. So I think the important thing, of course, is when you're blogging or when you're playing at being a journalist or, you know, commenting on media matters. And then I said to myself, even as I spoke about Ombak Rindu, I realized that I'd never seen the movie, but I had interviewed people about it. And so, you know, my views on it come from that kind of secondhand, is always to get the context of what you're doing and to perhaps pause and take a deep breath before you sort of post something. Because what the blogger suggested was that this was policy when, in fact, it was a single or, you know, instance or an instance that happened on irregular fashion.
Well, to be fair, and I guess that's my role here, she did add this caveat at the end of her blog, and I quote, "Whether this is a new policy or a one-time occurrence is unknown." And then she then asked for thoughts from those who actually read her blog.
Okay, so that's like all good journalists, you issue a correction or you put a question mark next to the assertion. Okay, there you have it. After these messages, we have Cher one of my favorite singers from a bygone era, Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Share with Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run continues. And we're looking briefly at a discussion, a storm in a teacup. And I think this is a particularly political teacup because I don't know if any of us care that on a banner, the heads of politicians appear in different sizes, and that signals something, apparently, something very important.
So this banner was found in Gelang Patah in Johor, and it features, well, it's apparently a banner for Parti Pribumi Bersatu Malaysia, right? Bersatu. But you've got DAP parliamentary leader, Lim Kit Siang, who is very much at the front of this.
He's the MP for Gelang Patah, isn't he?
Right, yeah. No, but then he's at the front of it, of this trio, you know, on the bottom right-hand corner of the banner, if you are really particular about the details. And then flanking him, the Gelang Patah Bersatu chief, Nasir Hashim, and the division's deputy chief, Samad Atan. So the storm in the teacup appears to be that, Lim Kit Siang should not have been front and center. He's way too big. It appears, or it makes him appear that he is the leader of Bersatu, as opposed to, you know, say, having Nasir Hashim or Samad Atan being more prominent in the layout, in the graphic design of this banner.
Okay, you know, look, if you live in Malaysia, you will know about the layout of political banners and this head shots that populate these banners and how they're placed in relation to them. And the fact that they never seem to come in the same size. Size apparently matters when it comes to politicians. Mm. And the bigger you're headed, the more prominent and important you are, apparently. Right. Now, I mean, what I can't get over, this was actually a story in, I believe, Malaysia Kini.
Yep.
And I was thinking how petty and silly this is, and why is it that politicians want us to spend mind space on something as trivial and nonsensical as this?
And it goes back to the story that we mentioned at the top of the hour, well, just after 6 a.m., talking about how that this is a brain drain in terms of limiting our cognitive capacity here. But I guess the fact that we are talking about it, you know, means that we have to do it, I don't know, I give it some attention, I guess.
Yeah. So I think it comes down to one of these things, right? One is a country or a society that plays a lot of importance on social hierarchy. Mm. So countries that are very hierarchical and societies and cultures that are very hierarchical always make this point, and right? And so there are all kinds of ways to signal whether where you are in that hierarchy. Because in hierarchical societies, there's always somebody below you, and there's hopefully, unless you're really bottom of the rung, or there's somebody above you, and right, you need to place yourself there.
And it's not something that's unique to the Malaysian context.
No, not at all.
Yeah, because I recall during a recent, I believe, G20 summit or one of the summits with Angela Merkel and Donald Trump, you know, and the order of who stood where, you know, and next to whom, that was placed, you know, there's so much significance was placed on the positions of these world
this
leaders.
This is one where Donald Trump pushed his way up to the front.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so he's very hierarchical, right? And so, you know, it's not like feudal societies, though I think feudal societies are particularly hierarchical. In capitalist societies, too, I mean, but there maybe the hierarchy is less complicated, and the people occupying those top positions could have come from the bottom of the rung. And in fact, you have these narratives within bourgeois capitalist societies that say, well, you know, the rags to riches story is very important. But, you know, if you are, say, in a feudal society, you probably want to not claim rags to riches as your story, but you will claim some great ancestry. So somebody might come in, become the king, and then he will claim that, you know, he's the descendant of some great king or other, you know, he'll find some lineage.
Right.
Well, so that's the difference between those societies now. But hierarchy remains.
Yeah, you know, I guess that's a very grandiose explanation for, you know, I want to be closest to, you know, the top dog, right?
The Velcro effect.
Ah,
there's that.
Pretty good, yeah.
But I must say, coming back to this banner again, you know, why is it that you think, I mean, Han, that politicians pay so much attention to this? And do they think that the rest of us care?
Well, you know, obviously politicians, they campaign based on popularity, right? So you want to be, you know, in the limelight. You want to be front and center as much as possible, right? You know, that, at least theoretically speaking, in the world of political science, you know, would gain you the most votes, you know, hopefully. But I guess in this case, and I'm going to go out on a limb here, you know, I wonder if Bersatu is, or at least in terms of the division over there in Gelang Patah, you know, are they so insecure that this warrants, you know, the kind of outcry that apparently has been guarded, you know, that Kit Siang is too large on this banner. Really, is that necessary? Is that conducive to the overall or the broader political discourse here in Malaysia? Come on now.
Yeah, okay. So the insecurity is an important, I think, factor in this. And I think across the aisle, on both sides, they're insecure politicians, and they're the ones who often, indulge in this. But it also kind of, it also suggests something about the coalition itself, right? Mm. As it forms, you know, Pakatan Harapan as well as Bersatu, maybe there's unease about the relationship. And that perhaps is also what's animating the discussion. So,
right. And then, you know, if you were to broaden that out to the coalition as a whole, you know, then what more about their, you know, say, projecting this image of unity, you know, having this unified challenge, you know, come GE14, because we are months away, or no more than, well, about a year away, you know, maximum from when the next general elections are scheduled to be held. When you have this kind of very petty squabbling, you know, what does that do for voter confidence? You know, can we place our trust in a coalition that squabbles over whose face is too large on a banner?
Yeah. So what we do know is this is not, it's not being taken up by the national leadership. It's probably something quite local that was picked up by Malaysia Kini. But you're absolutely right. A real sign of pettiness and perhaps, you know, the cracks that will show coming up to the general election. We don't know when it is, but I think this government has until the middle of next year.
Yeah, August of 2018, I believe. Yeah.
Absolutely. Next up, the mighty, mighty Boss Stones with The Impression That I Get. BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, with me Tan Chung Han, and the morning run continues. You just heard the news bulletin at 7, and we carry on with discussions of what's happening in the news. Over the weekend, motor insurance tariffs were liberalized, and that effect has included the fact that insurance companies are now taking into account a motorist's driving history. Mm. We spoke to Mark Lim, who is the CEO of Perbadanan Insurance AM Malaysia, and asked him if this move will change our driving behavior.
Well, this is interesting. You know, it is really a mindset change, and it might even take generations for this to happen. But what we are doing is to sow the seeds for transformation, so that motorists will now start to look at making a difference and adopting a good risk profile that would give them benefits in terms of a lower insurance premium. As you know, we have serious accident fatalities record in this country, and we hope that by asking drivers to drive safely and to inculcate safe driving habits, they will be more responsible on the roads, and thereby they will enjoy lower insurance premiums. So we're starting to shape motorist behavior and give them an incentive to drive safer and therefore reduce the accident rates in this country.
That's a really interesting comment there by Mark Lim, CEO of Perbadanan Insurance AM Malaysia, suggesting that higher premiums are there as a kind of policy device tool, and almost to shape behavior. But in fact, should your premiums be used in such a way? That's one of my questions.
Well, I think this system or this agenda to liberalize the insurance space here in Malaysia, on one hand, yes, it's aimed at motorists. Right? I think that us being the end users, right? I think that's the ultimate game in mind. But it also, there is this agenda to, you know, make the insurance space more competitive. So there is that element as well. Now, we will be speaking to Anthony Lee, who is the chairman of the General Insurance Association of Malaysia, to get his thoughts on this liberalization agenda or this de-tarification that kicked in over the weekend.
Right. So this is happening on the Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock. That's Anthony Lee, as you said, Chairman of General Insurance Association of Malaysia and CEO of AIG Malaysia.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Yeah. So if you have any questions, you can, of course, just let us know your opinions. You can tweet us at BFM Radio. You can text or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. That's 018-789-8899. Tell us what you think.
Yeah, so essentially, prior to this de-tarification that kicked in on July 1st, your insurance premiums was mainly calculated by the cubic capacity of your car, or basically the make and model of your car, and also the person, and also your NCD, right? But then now it's liberalized. There are several parameters that go into assessing your risk profile. So it involves, say, where you store your vehicle overnight, how you drive, obviously.
You mean like whether it's parked within a gated space or it's on the main road?
If it's a high-risk area, right, that it's subject to crime or theft. Even your gender, apparently, is going to be one of the parameters.
Ooh, this is – okay, so who's more risky?
It's men. So, at least according to studies done in the UK.
So it's discriminatory.
Yeah. So, because generally speaking, male drivers are take on a lot more risk and they do portray more riskier behavior.
So
on the road.
This is interesting, right? Mm. So the fact that there's a kind of gender dimension to this suggests that when you're talking about behavior modification, you really are dealing with the way people perceive the world, right? And I don't drive, so I don't understand, but I do watch people, other drivers, and the kinds of things that they do. And I do find that a lot of drivers, at least in the Klang Valley, are very inconsiderate. So they don't seem to be conscious of the fact that there are other people on the road, if they are conscious, they don't really care.
Right. Well, if you're going to subscribe to stereotypes, then sure. But you know what, Sharad, I'll do that for you. I will pose that question to Anthony Lee, again during the Breakfast Grill, which kicks off after the 8 a.m. news. But, I think also going back to this model of being able to assess this the risk profile of motorists here in Malaysia and have that risk being reflected in the insurance premiums or how much motorists will have to pay for the insurance every month or every year, I think that hopefully should translate into better driving standards moving forward.
Okay, driving standards aside,
driving
right?
Habits,
there's this, I think there's a lot of the discussion assumes that accidents are essentially caused by people, that accidents are there because people are callous or they take unnecessary risks and those risks don't pay off. In quite the way that they thought it would, meaning they're thinking they're going to save time. And you see a lot of this with people on motorbikes, which is that they take extraordinary risks because they always seem to be zipping in and out of cars thinking that they're beating the traffic jam, as it were, right? But I wonder to what extent our roads are safe, that our road systems themselves are, are the surfaces good enough? Are they, potholes? And I've seen potholes on, what would be an affluent neighborhood road. And, you're saying, why are those potholes there? Why don't they get covered up in time? Mm. When their road works, are there enough precautions taken? And if you remember in PJ, we had that terrible accident of this older man who drove into a... into a ditch that was,
sinkhole.
There was not a sinkhole, but it was, I think, some construction.
Yeah.
Right. So the question really to me is, okay, on balance, is it just a question of personal responsibility? To what extent are roads and our road system safe?
Certainly they play a part, but even on the safest roads or even on the smoothest roads, you're likely to have accidents as well, right? So I think, being able to address the human factor when it comes to the safety of our roads, not just the level of infrastructure, as you rightly pointed out, and every year, when it comes to the federal budget and also the state government budget, we talk about how there's always funds allocated towards the upkeep of these the quality of our roads, right? Now, whether they are successfully implemented, that's a whole different discussion. But I think in this sense, having the insurance premiums being reflective of the kind of risk or at least the kind of habits being displayed by that individual driver, I think that should should go a long ways in terms of not just, you know, changing, or hopefully not just changing our driving habits, but also again the industry, the insurance industry here in Malaysia.
Okay, so but coming back to the question that, you know, we asked Mark, which was, you know, the question of behavior. Now I do think that there is a question of policy, right? And how do you change habits? Now, you know, for the longest time, you could commit a traffic offense, and a lot of people thought you could get off with it by paying a bribe. And so corruption, I think, is part of this narrative, the idea that those in charge of enforcement were infinitely corruptible. I mean, you know, we're talking about 30 ringgit or 50 ringgit, you know, as a way of, you know, inducing somebody not to, to slap a fine on you or to make you go to court for, say, dangerous driving or something, right? Or taking a wrong turn, or, you know, taking a U-turn where you're not supposed to U-turn, for instance. And all that, I wonder if also has played into the culture of driving in Malaysia, that for so long, maybe it's not so currently, I don't know what the situation is in terms of corruption among traffic policemen, but, you know, with the idea that you can get away with things maybe really push people to drive badly.
But I think very often when we have that discussion, you know, often the traffic police are made the scapegoat, or they are the ones who are painted to be like solely responsible, when, hey, it takes two to tango, right? So if you're not giving,
I was going to say, yeah, absolutely
right. You know, so, you know, I think very much Malaysian society, and again, granted, I'm using this really, really broad brush here, but Malaysian society has a role to play in stemming the level of corruption as well. No, if you, and look, you know, paying your fines now, apparently a lot, they've made it a lot more convenient, if I can use that word. You can actually pay for your traffic fines, your PDRM fines at ATMs.
But if you could pay 10% of what the fine is, so that's where the corruption
exactly.
mentality comes in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that kicks in. Though I think the electronic monetary systems are supposed to eliminate the human element, right?
So multifaceted approach, or, you know, many, many different factors to be addressed when it comes to the overall safety of motorists here in Malaysia. But hey, we're going to be speaking about the de-tarification of motor insurance on The Breakfast Grill. Yep.
We'll be back after this, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.